असतो मा सद्गमया तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमया मृत्योर्मा अमृतंगमया ओम शांति शांति शांतिः हरिः ओम। लॉर्ड लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल, लीड अस फ्रॉम इग्नोरेंस to illumination, lead us from death to immortality. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all.
There are many here. If asked whether you are a Hindu, they will say definitely yes. And further, if we ask, why do you think you are a Hindu? Various answers will be given. Because I was born to Hindu parents, because I worship a particular Hindu deity, or I was born in a particular caste, etc., or I believe in some scriptures, etc. Some of the answers are definitely right, some are not. So that is one. And many of the people who claim they are Hindus, excepting claiming that they are Hindus, know very little about Hinduism. There are three main reasons why this is so. The first reason is that there is no centralized body, central authority to define, to fix and say this is what is Hinduism and this is not what is not Hinduism. So that is the first reason. The second reason is Hinduism is so vast that it is, as humorously I mentioned many times, it is like a supermarket. You can worship any god, any name, any way you like. You can follow any particular system of yoga. You can belong to any particular school of philosophy. You can do any number of weird things and be proud that I am a good Hindu. It is one reason. And part of this reason is also that until recently, until almost the 19th century, there was no such religion called Hinduism. There was only some type of practice or practices approved by some local guru or some insignificant scripture, etc. Yes, they are asked, are you a Hindu? Yes. But if you are asked why you are a Hindu and what exactly is Hinduism, and especially if the children are non-Hindus, ask the so-called Hindus, can you tell me briefly what Hinduism is? They are at a sea. All that they can tell is, this is what we do. I go to a temple, I break some coconuts, sometimes on the stone, sometimes on the priest's head, and that's all they know. And they think they know. So that only when Swami Vivekananda came, of which I will come very shortly, Hinduism as a definite name of a particular religion hadn't become popular at all. Of course, the very name itself is a misnomer, which also I will come back very shortly. Third reason is, very surprising, people don't care. Hindus never care, unless they are asked, you know, you are confronted. So, who are you? I'm a Hindu. So, can you tell me what is the fundamental issues of your religion? As one fellow said, you know, one man was asked, have you read Hindu scriptures? He said, no. Are you a Hindu? Yes. And how did you know? Because my Swami told me that I'm a Hindu. I also write in the, you know, certificate, I'm a Hindu. So, have you read any scriptures? No. Lots of this applies not only to Hindus, but the followers of any religion. You ask them, have you really read the basic fundamental scriptures of your own religion properly? All that they know is, they go to the church or the mosque and they are told certain things, and depending upon who is telling, the definition of their religion lies. Because people really don't care what the scriptures are trying to tell. And it was not really necessary at a particular point of time, because supposing you are in India and you are following Hinduism in a remote village. There was no challenge. Nobody will challenge you, you are a Hindu. Nobody will ask you whether you are a Hindu, what is Hinduism. But the moment you are confronted with somebody else, a Christian, or you have to live with somebody who believes differently, and especially if those people with whom you are living are very inimical to you, then the question comes, what is my identity? This is one. Secondly, nowadays, because of this marriage, intermixed marriage, inter-religious marriages are taking place. Now the problem comes, how do we raise our children? Which religion we either they completely ignore them, so we won't teach anything, let them learn by themselves, or if they're very particular, they suffer severely because the husband and wife never agree with each other. What to be taught? Sometimes it's very controversial. One of the biggest problems in the USA that has come in, a school, in the schools, the government wanted to introduce prayer. There was a lot of controversy. We don't believe in religion. We don't want our children to be brainwashed into these outmoded thoughts. Somehow, some people agreed that there should be a prayer. But there the progress stopped because the problem came, which type of prayer would you like to have? Is it a Christian prayer? Is it a Muslim prayer? Is it a Jewish prayer? Or is it a Hindu prayer? Hindus, of course, have no problem at all. Because any God is good enough. Any prayer is good enough. This particular prayer, which I had uttered at the beginning of my talk, is one of the most ancient and also one of the most non-controversial type of prayers. All that it says is, O Lord, lead me from the unreal to the real, from non-truth to truth. Lead me from ignorance to knowledge. Lead me from death or unhappiness to immortality or eternal happiness. This is a beautiful prayer. But if people come to know that this prayer is a translation of a Hindu Vedic prayer, immediately the problem comes. Hindus have no problem about this. Another reason why I am taking up this is, of course, some of our devotees, they have been very insistent that I should take a fairly detailed study of Hinduism. It's useful in many ways. Is that nowadays many Hindus are living in outside India. Do you know how many Hindus are living in UK? Almost 600,000 Hindus are there. In USA, there are almost 1 million Hindus are there. And more also will come. Now, the first generation never had this problem. But the second generation, one big question. Am I a Hindu? Before we study what is Hinduism, briefly, I would like to point out certain facts. This is the third biggest religion in the whole world. Biggest followers are Christianity. Almost there are 2.1 billion followers. Next is Islam. It is 1.5 billion. Of course, these figures are some time back. Now it might have been even more. So Christianity is the major religion, in a sense, the largest number of followers. Then come Islam. Then comes Hinduism. Almost, estimates vary, but I would say from 900 million to 1 billion, a little more than 1 billion, as it stands today. What a marvelous thing it is, almost 1 billion. Anyway, so Confucianism, Buddhism, 376 million, Sikhism, 23 million, Judaism, 14 million, Baha'i, 7 million, Jainism, 4.2 million, Shintoism, 4 million, Zoroastrianism, 2.6 million, Taoism, not exactly, figures are not there, but somewhere around a few hundred thousand followers are there. So this is the major statistics. So Hinduism is the third largest followers in the whole world, almost a billion. That is one of the reasons why Hinduism should be studied very well. Also, we are all following Hinduism. It's good to know what our religion is exactly teaching and what is it that distinguishes us from the followers of other religions. And most of the Hindus were of course live in India, but there are also Hindus in Bangladesh, Myanmar. I don't know how many Hindus have died in this recent cyclone. Sri Lanka, Fiji, Guyana, Nepal, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, South Africa, Mauritius, Suriname, Trinidad, Tobago, Canada, Netherlands, and of course our own United Kingdom. So why do we need to discuss about Hinduism? I already gave you three reasons. One reason is that very few know what Hinduism is. Secondly, we need to know because we have to define ourselves, otherwise we lose our identity. Suppose you are Hindus, you know you are Hindus. Suppose you don't know anything about Hinduism. Then a time will come when you might suffer terribly. One of the biggest strengthening factors of the ego is religion. Next to, I would say even higher than nationality, language, race, and religion. These are the four major ego-strengthening bonds. Just imagine a person without any nationality. Where do you think you will put him? Somehow he lands, he will be put in the airport. One fellow stayed nearly 12 years in Paris airport because the French nationals were not taking him in, and he cannot go anywhere because there is no visa or anything. So that is one. Secondly, if we do not identify ourselves with any race, particular race or culture, then who am I? Then language. If we always, even though we know many languages, for example, every Indian, at least the first generation Indians, they have two languages, their own mother tongue, and also the country where they are living and working. Now, that is a very strengthening thing. When you meet somebody who also speaks the same language, somehow you feel a kind of affinity. They may not matter much at this stage, but if psychologically we are disturbed, then these are the things which will come to our aid. Unconsciously, how much we are deriving our strength from these things, that is something very wonderful. It's an altogether another subject. But the most strengthening of all these bonds is religious bond, because religious bond is to just overstep. There is no boundaries of nations or culture or anything. For example, Muslims, to whichever country they belong, whichever language they speak, whatever may be their eating habits, whatever may be the color of their skin, they all have tremendous bondage. So, but if it is cultivated consciously, then we have a lot to gain from it. So coming back now, one of the reasons I mentioned was that until 19th century, very few Hindus I'm talking about, know very little about what Hinduism was about. Hinduism itself was born at the Chicago Parliament of Religions in the 19th century, and Swami Vivekananda was the person who founder of Hinduism, not in the sense of the basics, but in the sense of defining it, making it clear, so that we know now what Hinduism is all about. And he had summarized this, though he didn't call it Hinduism. Swamiji, Sridharamakrishna used to call what we call Hinduism, Sanatana Dharma. Swami Vivekananda preferred to call it is Vedantic. We are followers of Vedanta. Vedanta means everything that is the teachings of Vedas. The teachings of Vedas is called Vedanta. So it could be followers of dualism, followers of qualified non-dualism, followers of non-dualism. You worship Shiva, worship Vishnu, worship Devi, Goddess, doesn't matter whom you worship. We follow Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, Raja Yoga, Jnana Yoga. We follow Bhagavad Gita, follow Upanishads, follow any Purana. It doesn't matter to you. So he defined it as is somebody tell the essence of Vedanta in four sentences. You know what that is. Each soul is potentially divine, and the goal is to manifest this divinity within by controlling nature, external and internal, and manifest this divine nature by following either through work or worship or through meditation or the path of knowledge, by one, more, or all of these together, and be free. And lastly, he says, temples, churches, books, doctrines, dogmas, all these are but secondary details. Very abstract way he had defined this thing. But based upon his paper on Hinduism at the Chicago Parliament of Religions, we have drawn four pillars of Hinduism. Before I proceed further, I would like to place before you that. Because if you don't come back to this series of talks again, you will know what Hinduism is all about. If you just remember these four points. The first pillar of Hinduism is mukti. This springs from the belief that we are all originated from divinity, from God. Therefore, it is our inevitable destination is again going back to God. We have come from God, so we go to God. At the moment, we have forgotten. This is called Maya, forgetfulness of one's own true nature, true identity is called Maya or Avidya. So, what is the goal? To know what one is and to realize what one is. We come to know who we are from the scriptures and we realize it by following the teachings of the Upanishads or Vedanta, and ultimately we realize who we are, and then what happens? We become free. Now we are not free. We will become free. Freedom. This freedom is called mukti or moksha. The second pillar is that moksha or mukti, liberation, cannot be attained by proxy, by vicarious experience, but only through direct experience called sakshatkara, aparoksha anubhuti. Direct experience. This is the second pillar. The third pillar is the law of the chosen deity. Means you can worship God, think of God, pray to God in any name, any form, any quality. You have complete freedom to choose how you would like to think of God. This is the very special contribution of Hinduism to every other religious thought. This is the third principle, is the law of the Ishta Devata, chosen deity. As a corollary, Hindus also believe what we call God's incarnation, not once, again and again and again, as many times as necessary. That is the third pillar. And the fourth pillar is the law of karma. Even if you don't believe or don't understand all these three fundamental principles, but one thing is very clear, the law of cause and effect. So a corollary of this law of karma is, we had births before, and we are going to have many more lives. How long? Until we attain mukti or liberation. So the law of karma. This is the fourth pillar. Four pillars. Liberation is the goal of life. Direct knowledge that you are divine is the only way. And you can worship God, this is called spiritual practice, in any manner you like, but be free. And the last is the law of karma. And if you get lost on the way, do not worry. When you are ready, God is ready to guide you. How? He will guide you through a system, beautiful system. In English it is called GPS. You know what it is? Guru Sishya system. Guru, teacher, disciple, per system. It's a tradition. Guru Sishya system. G P the parampara, guru parampara. So these are the four fundamental principles. Now coming back, I said that until the 19th century, Hinduism was flourishing. It is one of the oldest religions. How old? At least 11,000 years old. There was a river called Saraswati, northwestern borders of India. And on the banks of this river Saraswati, this what is called Hindu's civilization had flourished for thousands of years, of which just a few last century they had dug a little bit, remnants at Harappa, Mohenjo-daro, etc., found out that the origins of this Indian civilization goes back almost to, at least without doubt, 4,000 years old. But then recently some more developments had come and found out at some point this ocean was far away from the present landmark, and the Saraswati River civilization was flourishing there, and because of some natural changes the ice started melting. Slowly the what is called the levels of the sea went up and it started eroding the lands until we now have the present situation where several wonderful cities had been inundated by the sea, lie under the sea. We also have a faith that Dwaraka was one of those victims of at the end of the Dwapara Yuga, at the time of Sri Krishna's disappearance. So they have been finding proofs. From all these proofs, we can find that Hinduism, if not older, at least 11,000 years old. And I do not think any religion can claim that it is that old. It's one of the oldest religions. And yet, until last century, every Hindu knew he was a Hindu, and he followed certain things of teachings of Hinduism, but never knew what was proper scientific way of defining or explaining Hinduism. It was given to Swami Vivekananda to define it. So here is what Sister Nivedita writes in the introduction to the complete works of Swami Vivekananda. In the four volumes of the works of Swami Vivekananda, which are to compose the present edition, we have what is not only a gospel to the world at large, but also to its own children, the charter of the Hindu faith, what Hinduism needed amidst the general disintegration of the modern era, was a rock where she could lie at anchor, an authoritative utterance in which she might recognize herself. And this was given to her in these words and writings of the Swami Vivekananda for the first time in history.
As has been said elsewhere, Hinduism itself forms here the subject of generalization of a Hindu mind of the highest order. For ages to come, the Hindu man who would verify, the Hindu mother who would teach her children what was the faith of their ancestors, will turn to the pages of these books for assurance and light. Long after the English language has disappeared from India, the gift that has been here made through that language to the world will remain and bear its fruit in East and West alike. What Hinduism had needed was the organizing and consolidating of its own idea. What the world has needed was a faith that had no fear of truth. Both these are found here. Having said this, Sister Nivedita clinches the argument and says, of the Swami's address before the Parliament of Religions, it may be said that when he began to speak, it was of the religious ideas of the Hindus. But when he ended, Hinduism has been created. So, the word general religious ideas of Hindus have been explained by Swami Vivekananda. But when he ended, Hinduism was born. What is the difference? The difference was a systematic, organized, well-defined, clear definition of what is Hinduism. This was the great contribution of Swami Vivekananda, if not the greatest contribution for Hindus at least. Okay, so the idea Hinduism though as old as the Vedas, and yet so systematically presented, was born only about 100 years back. Now, before we discuss important points of Hinduism, we have to understand first, we are studying not a culture, but a religion. And what is a religion? If you ask, do you know about religion? Oh yes, we are religious followers. And what do you mean by religion? Well, I go to the Swami's talks. Is that religion? I eat prasada in the temple. Is that religion? I read books. Is that religion? You can go on describing many things, but you could be as irreligious as anybody who had never done these things. We must have good, right understanding of what religion is. The first question, is it possible for us to be without any religion? If we understand what religion is properly, yes, it is not possible. Because religion is a constitutional necessity of every being, not only of human beings. Does an animal have religion? So long as it is living, it has a religion. But what is the religion? That's where Swami Vivekananda's contribution is very useful for us to understand. So what is religion? Religion is an attempt to gain more and more freedom. This is how I will put it. Religion is an attempt to gain more and more freedom. If your eyes are able to look only a little bit, and you invent specs and able to see better, or you invent telescope, microscope, able to better, so what is that you have gained? You have become little more free, you have attained a little more freedom, you have limited your limitedness to that extent, though that is not the end of the religion, but that is the beginning of religion. That is what Swami Vivekananda defines religion as, the attempt to go beyond the five sense organs, to go beyond the limitation of the senses. Why do we want to go? Why do you want to go? Because there is an, what we call in philosophical language, a teleological urge, an unstoppable type of force within us which says, I want more freedom. Anything that is restraining you, anything that is constricting you, you would like to break that in any way of speaking. Why does a man get married? A simple question. Why does a man get married? To attain more freedom. He's not, he's lonely. I want a companion. I am not very happy. So he wants freedom from limitation means suffering here. And why does he get divorced? To get more freedom. This is the truth. Freedom, happiness, peace, progress, these are all synonymous words. So we will discuss about it in a little more detail a bit later on, but for the first, religion is a constitutional necessity. Even if you tie up a dog, it will not keep quiet. It wants to be freed. What do you think it wants to do after you free it? Suppose you tied a dog and it is struggling. It doesn't want the chain. Then you remove the chain. What do you think it will do? It will be exactly there only. It doesn't want the chain. That's all. So this is what is a constitutional necessity. Why is it a necessity? Because Swamiji had a wonderful theory. This theory is called the theory about evolution. You know what we are talking about? Evolution. This word evolution means from a lower species, slowly the species are evolving into higher and higher beings. Darwin was one of the people, but Darwin was not the only person. There are three concepts about evolution. The first concept is biological concept. Everything has come out of nature. It is blind. So it is creation is an accident. Nobody had done it on any purpose. So somehow it wants to survive. Someone wants to spread its species. So it's competition for mate, competition for food, and whichever animal is successful, and that animal has remained alive. If it is not successful, what happens then? Then it will evolve into higher species. Mind you, successful means, in a way of speaking, death. The cockroach was very successful, but it remained a cockroach only. But whereas so many animals, in the process they died. But one or two perhaps, they had developed an extra some facility. And the next it passed on its genes to its offspring. Slowly a small animal became, for example, a giraffe. That is why it is said, the price biological evolution pays is millions, million times death. Million, million times death. Only after so many deaths, slowly, very slow progress into higher species. This is purely a biological explanation, because what is the goal? What is the end? All right, you have evolved into a human animal. What now? What now? Kill each other. Through wars, through in the name of religion, in the name of God, everything. That's not an what is called proper explanation, satisfactory explanation. The second idea, that there is a creative urge within each one of us. You see, you look at a bird, and a bird needs a nest for it to stay in safety. But it doesn't stop at just building a nest. It wants to build a beautiful nest. And you know, many species, they have got colorful feathers, beautiful beaks, etc. You know, animals, you say, you think only human beings are undergoing this cosmetic surgery and all those things. Even animals also have evolved wonderful ways of attracting, even plants also, colors, etc., to attract perfumes, colors, shapes, etc., to attract their prey. So why do there is an unstoppable creative faculty within all creatures, and that is what leads one ultimately to the evolving higher and higher species. But this also is inadequate explanation. There is a third view, which is called the Vedantic view or the spiritual view, that is, we have come from God, and coming down from God is called involution. So now we have gone down to the rock bottom. What is the rock bottom? You have become a lump of clay, matter, lifeless. But from there, there is no further down to go. Now the only way is to come up. That's what is called in English language, evolution. But what Swamiji calls here, this evolution, is going back to our origins. So from a lowest manifestation, and we from what is called existence, then we develop chit, which is more consciousness, then ultimately we end in becoming one with the infinite. So the finite, trying to become one with its true nature, which is infinity, is what is called spiritual view of evolution. And it is inevitable, whether we like it or not. You can postpone it for some time, but it is inevitable, because that divine nature is urging you to go up and up and up. It won't stop until you reach your true nature, which is God. This is called spiritual. So what is religion? Religion is a systematic attempt at evolving ourselves truly into our own nature. This is called religion. Therefore, it is a constitutional necessity, because you are not learning it in you. It is this which is pushing us up and up and up. So how did religion origin? It's very important to know, because supposing after hearing my talks, you would like to have a little browse, a little bit of Vedas. And what do you see? You will open the pages of the, say, Rig Veda. And then say, there is, it says, oh, clouds, you please pour rain upon us. What is this? This fellow is saying, here I thought I will hear something about God, and here is a prayer. Or a tree. Oh, tree, you are divinity itself. You know, there were plants which were divinized in our Vedas. One of the plants' name is very interesting. It is called Somalata. Somalata yields Somarasa. We have to know, if you have to understand the scriptures, one point you have to make it clear in your mind, that the whole scripture doesn't contain all the highest truths only. From the very beginnings of understanding what is life about, what is religion about, what we ought to do in life, whether we should pray, etc., until a person comes who had realized his true identity and pours forth is what is called adulation. These are called suktas, or praises, that I am the Father in heaven, I am the Deus, I am Indra, I am Varuna, I am Brahma. The highest of that statement is Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. And even better than that is Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. Everything is that divinity itself. I am the ultimate reality. Everything is ultimate reality. So when you understand a little bit the beginnings of religion, very briefly, religious growth had undergone in two stages. The first, there are two theories about it. I better read Swami Vivekananda's, because that is what he defines. Various attempts have been made to trace the beginnings of religion. In all the ancient religions which have come down to us at the present day, we find one claim made, that all are supernatural, that their genesis is not as it were in the human brain, but that they have originated somewhere outside of it. No religious scripture will ever tell you that what you call the scriptures, religious scripture, the foundations of every religion lies in some scriptures. Whether they believe in God, do not believe in God, every religion must have a book. Before going further, I also want to clarify a few points. One is, there are two types of religions. Historic religions, non-historic religions. Historic religions like Christianity, like Islam, they claim that their religion started in history, means in verifiable time, at some point of time in history, by a person who really lived here. For example, who was the founder of Christianity? Christ. Who was the founder of Islam? Muhammad. So, but Christianity arose from Christ when? 2000 years back. So, Islam had risen from Prophet Muhammad when? Almost about 600 AD. About 1400 years back, right? But if you ask a Hindu, what does he say? He says ours is non-historic religion. What does he mean? He means it Hinduism did not start. I will come back to that point. Hinduism, I said, is a misnomer. Sanatana Dharma, eternal religion, or Vedanta, whatever. It did not start at a particular point. It is a continuous development from the very beginning. Only we have gone back to some distance in the past, and then we say this is all we know when we find it there. It is not that it started there. This is like Gomukhi. You know, somebody goes to find the origins of Ganga. Up to where he goes? Up to Gomukhi. Gomukhi is not the origin of Ganges. Gomukhi is Ganges comes out where you can really see it in a concrete form. It originated somewhere far behind it. So, that's why Hinduism is a non-historic religion. Then what is the big deal of difference? Because if you prove that there was no such person called Christ, the foundation, very foundation of Christianity will fall down. But if you prove that Hinduism has no history, it gets more strength because it did not origin at a particular point of time. This is one point. Another point difference is, Hinduism is an ethnic religion. It used to be an ethnic religion, now a missionary religion. Whereas, what you call Abrahamic religions, or Semitic religion. From among them, there are three, Judaism, Christianity and Islam. Judaism remained, almost until recently, an ethnic religion, confined only to a small number of its followers. That means they can become Jews only by birth. Now it has changed a little bit. But it was never, even today it is not a missionary religion. Even today Hinduism is not a missionary religion. Whereas the offshoots of Hinduism like Buddhism have become terribly missionary religions. So this is another distinction that is to be made. In any case, even when Christians or Muslims or Jews claim that theirs is a historic religion, what we have to understand is not that there was nothing before that. Before Christ came, was there no religion? What do you mean by Christianity? It is a modification of Judaism suitable to those particular times. That's all. What is Islam? That is another modification of, you can say, the earlier paganism or whatever you call it, religions existing. So religion itself has no beginning. What we have to understand is these great personalities have given it a definite shape and then also modified it in a way suitable for those particular times. That is what we should understand by the meaning of historic religions. Okay. But as I said, there are no real beginnings of religion. But we see certain longings. There are two theories about this. This is what Swami Vivekananda is telling. Two theories have gained some acceptance among us modern scholars. One is the spirit theory of religion, and second, the evolution of the idea of the infinite. What does he mean? One party maintains that ancestor worship is the beginning of religious ideas. The other, that religion originates in the personification of the powers of nature. Man wants to keep up the memory of his dead relatives and thinks they are living even when the body is dissolved, and he wants to place food for them and in a certain sense to worship them. Well, out of that came the growth we call religion. This is one theory. Studying the ancient religions of the Egyptians, Babylonians, Chinese and many other races in America and elsewhere, we find very clear traces of this ancestor worship being the beginning of religion. For example, with the ancient Egyptians, the first idea of the soul was that of a devil. Why did they build pyramids? Because they thought the physical body has its double. The physical body is dead, but so long as it is kept intact, its counterpart there will be there. That is why they used to bury their wives, horses, chariots, gold. He will be needing it there also. Do Hindus have that? Yes, we also worship. It's a peculiar idea. You see it many times. You see, we call it not only our ancestors are worshipped, they are also regarded. It's a regardless of whether they are scoundrels, crooks, rogues. After death, they will become, you know, great. They will go to a loka called Pitruloka, a father's land. And there they remain forever, demanding some people, if they are good children, and then monthly worship, monthly offerings. If they are not such good children, at least annual worship. If even still more worse children, at least once after death, some give some offering, whatever you can give. It is there, ancestral worship. And has it disappeared? No, it hasn't disappeared. How do we know? Here is a very peculiar idea which I also don't understand. Take for example, Sri Ramakrishna's father. He went to Gaya. What was the purpose? He wanted to offer his worship of his ancestors. And what did he see? He saw, after all the worship was done, that all his ancestors were present in the temple. And then he had the vision of Gaya Vishnu, and he who said, I am going to be born as your son. Now, it is a very peculiar idea, I said. Why did I say that? Because according to Hindus, life is a continuous evolution. So my great-grandfather had died. Do I always want him to remain there in the same way? Or do I want him to attain mukti and then get out of this samsara? So if he had really got out of this Pitruloka, maybe for some time he was there, but after some time he has to be reborn. If he is reborn, what is the meaning of my seeing him there? These are difficult ideas. But my interpretation is, it is the devotion that is more important in our minds, rather than we are not confining them there. Be careful. You know, otherwise what happens? Your children will confine you there in future. So the idea is that ancestors, they must be living. What is the idea behind? There is a simple idea. That idea is, death is not an end of life itself. It is a continuation. They go to some other place and they also live there, which is very reasonable. But to confine them to a particular place or a time period, that would be our mistake. Okay. So this is one idea, worship of the ancestors. Along with this idea, there is another idea. So when we open our eyes and look at the people around us, what do we see? That all people are not exactly the same. They are not machine-produced dolls. Each one is different in intelligence, in beauty, in power, manifestation of the life, is it not? Suppose we see a person like Swami Vivekananda. Even if we are not followers of religion, do we know that Swami Vivekananda is highly admired in Russia? Highly admired. Books have been written on Swami Vivekananda. If you ask, do you believe in what he preached about God and soul and other things? They said no. They say no. We are not admiring Swami Vivekananda because of his ideas about religion or God or soul. We admire him because his large-heartedness, what is called socialism. He was a great socialist. He wanted everybody to have equal share of the happiness of this world. He wanted to serve human beings. This at least was the idea of what is called socialism. And Swami Vivekananda's idea has been very brilliantly taken up. They have done research jobs. So, such a person, we wish that what is the difference between him and me? I also perhaps could have been him. So, what is it that makes him so great? There must be something in him. So, I would not like to let him go. So, I would like to worship him. What is the idea? By following him, I would somehow become like him. And I will have more freedom, more power, more manifestation of my potential divinity. In some tribes, this peculiar idea has taken bizarre manifestations. For example, cannibalism. Suppose there is a very powerful tribal leader and he dies. Then the tribal people believed, they don't know about soul and other things. But this man was most courageous chief. And he had these wonderful qualities of, you know, intelligence, organizing power, protecting power. So how can we have that power? Let us eat a little bit of him. Is it such a bizarre idea? In case you are thinking, we are not like that. Sir, whenever you eat a little bit of prasada, don't forget what are you eating. What is prasada? You offer a piece of banana to Thakur, and what does that piece of banana becomes a part of? Thakur himself. So when we are partaking of it, what are we doing? We are eating Thakur. But then is it not cannibalism? No. Why, you know? Because Thakur was like a light. You can light a billion. It's like a digital copy. Uncorruptedly you can copy any number of copies. So the original light will not lose anything by taking help of its help and lighting other lamps. So by becoming Ramakrishna, you are not going to make him less. Rather, you are also going to join him. If you become like Ramakrishna, what happens? Ramakrishna becomes a little bigger. So this is the idea. This is the idea of, you know, in the church they do it. They offer wine and bread and these things. Okay, this ancestor worship. So these are the 2 points we have to keep in our mind. One is, we do not want to think anybody is dead. We want to think somehow they are surviving somewhere. So, what is the extension of this idea? If they can survive, we can also survive. That is the idea. And supposing we come to know very definitely they can survive, but there is no hope of our surviving. Will you worship the ancestors? No. This is one. And you find traces of it in the Vedas, etc., very many places. So, the second idea. Thus, it seems, on the one hand, a very good position is made out for those who hold the theory of ancestor worship as the beginning of religion. On the other hand, there are scholars who from the ancient Aryan literature show that religion originated in nature worship. The thunderbolt, the dark clouds. If you want to know what nature is, go to India. You will see in the rainy season. Here, you know, small clouds here and there. There, huge clouds. There it pours. You know how it pours? Not cats and dogs. Tigers and elephants, it pours. Yes, literally. You just see the cyclones, the tornadoes, the earthquakes, the huge mountains, wonderful deserts. When you see this natural phenomena, the rise of the sun, the stars, and then you wonder. Then you see, here also, why nature worship? What is worship? Worship is, as I said, one thing, the attempt to get out of the limitations of the senses or to gain more freedom. Put your same idea. Now, if there is lightning, if there is thunder, my whole life is in a very precarious condition. Then who is the cause of these rains? Who is making it to do it? They did not know what nature was. Only now we think we know. We think we know. If you ask a scientist, this is suns, Hindus worship the sun god. If you ask a modern scientist, what do you see there? It is just a burning star. It is gas burning. It is materialistic vision. Whereas when a devout Hindu gets up early in the morning, faces the rising sun, and offers and says, Bhargo devasya dhimahi dhiyo yo naha prachodayat, he is not talking about a gas burning there. Why? Because he had a special sense, what is called intuitive sense. There have been sages who have seen the inner divinity. This is called devatatma. Everything is pervaded by a devata. Not in the sense of the nature worship, but in the sense of real divinity manifesting there. Anyway, our ancestors who did not know the secrets of nature, they thought there must be somebody. And it is absolutely true. They were right. In one way, it was animated. But they were wrong in the other way, that they are not ordinary powers. They were God himself. They wanted protection. They wanted some kind of favors for crops, etc. Today I was praying. So yesterday, Saturday, no talk, and it was brilliant. Today morning, my talk is there in the afternoon, and it is very cloudy. Oh God, you see, so many people want to come, or they're threatening to come. So if you are raining, what is going to happen to all of them? So God seemed to have listened and said, all right, afternoon, I will make it cloudy, rain-free. Whether it is coincidence or what, because they are predicting whole day heavy rains. So all is well that ends well. But the point is, being buffeted by these, what is called life's forces, natural forces, man had no option but to think and say, what can I do to make them favorable? That is how worship of nature had started. But the essence is the same. By worshipping either ancestors or by worshipping nature, the essence is, I want more freedom. I want more happiness. I want not to suffer. I want to go beyond the limitations of the senses. That is the most important point Swamiji is trying to make here. So in the struggle, they endow these phenomena with personal attributes, giving them souls and bodies, sometimes beautiful, sometimes transcendent. Every attempt ends by these phenomena becoming abstractions, whether personalized or not. So also it is found with the ancient Greeks. Their whole mythology is simply this abstracted nature worship. So also with the ancient Germans, the Scandinavians, and all the other Aryan races. Thus, on this side too, a very strong case has been made out that religion has its origin in the personification of the powers of nature. Now, the important point we have to keep in mind is, when you go back to the study of the so-called Vedas or even Upanishads, you will see there are plenty of instances of what you might think worship of nature. In this, there are again two points to be understood. One point is, there were some who animated every tree, every mountain, every river, every cloud with some kind of spirit so that they can get protection, they can get some favors, etc., etc. But there are also others who saw the real divinity there. What is the big deal of difference between these two views? After all, both are endowing nature with spirit. Then what is the big deal of difference? The difference is, there are two people who are praying to God. One person is praying to God, oh Lord, give me more money, more long life, more enjoyments. What is he trying to do? Is he trying to get mukti, or is he trying to go deeper into the bondage of samsara? The other person is also praying to God. What is he saying? Oh Lord, you please grant me freedom. I want to come to you. I want to get out of this limited, limitations of your samsara. I want to become infinite. Both are praying to the same God, but the ends, the purposes are different. Those people crude people, crude minds, who are animating nature with powers. What are they doing? They want to live in this world, first of all. They don't want any suffering. Secondly, they want to live very happily in this world. That is the purpose. Whereas there are also rishis who realized God in their depths of meditation, but when they came down, they saw the manifestation of that same divinity within each and every atom of this creation. This is what we see in Sri Ramakrishna's practice of tantras. Every plant, every animal, every piece of dust, speck of dust, is nothing but the manifestation of the divinity. It is quite opposite. The motive, the purpose, the end is completely opposite. But we get traces of both these things in the Vedas. I will just give you one example. So there is, O Varuna, we are suffering from lack of rain. Please bestow your grace and may we have more rains. This belongs to the first category where we want to live happily in this world. Whereas another rishi who realized God is praying, I am the Varuna, I am the Indra, I am Pitru, I am every Aryama, I am Yama, I am everybody. Everything is none but myself. Here he is also naming, this is Varuna, this is cloud, this is waters, this is Surya. But here he is saying, I am Brahman. The language is the same, but the meaning is totally opposite to each other. You will see both these things side by side in our Vedantic scriptures. But the points we have discussed is, religion is constitutional necessity of every human being. Religion, the idea of religion, has started in two ways. One is worship of the ancestors, worship of ghosts, etc. The other is what is called animating nature with spirit or some extra supernatural powers, etc. These two seem to be the main causes of the growth of religious idea. Now, Swamiji, having enumerated this one, he comes and says, these are not, though seemingly they are opposed ideas, but there is no real opposition there. If we go deep into it, we see it is one expression, but two manifestations. One idea, two expressions, two manifestations. He says, I will try to reconcile with my own wonderful idea. We will see in our next class that how the religious idea, the idea of the numinous, has taken over and pervading both these ideas and how it develops further. Having explained a little bit that one, then we will go straight into our main subject, what is Hinduism. I will not go into too deep a detail, nor will I be very, very brief. I will tread the middle path where I will give sufficient explanation for us to understand, trying to make it as clear as possible. Let us all enjoy. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.